Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Thursday morning, we are about, 18 hours since the mansion goalpost got moved again, but this time to the left and not to the right. So Democrats, I guess it's not all said and done. There's always possibilities for more drama, but it does look pretty promising that Biden's going to get some more points on the scoreboard. And this is right around the heels of the Senate passing the CHIPS bill, robust investment in semiconductor manufacturing and scientific research. But then I just see this morning that we got negative 0.9% GDP. So Democrats can never get a full 24 hours of just straight good news.
Yes. And I think that is actually kind of indicative of the way things are going right now, is that it's really hard to have a clear narrative. There's the data points are very contradictory, but it does help to put points on the board. I don't know how much it helps electorally, but certainly if you're Joe Biden, you want to have a legacy. And if you're Joe Manchin, he is also running out of time. Bill, a point you've made, I think, here more than anyone.
Well, I had a piece just published Monday afternoon, which obviously is what tipped the scales here. I mean, if anyone gets credit for this deal, exclusive must credit Bill Scheer. The planet Earth is not saved unless I write my piece for Real Clear Politics. I just made the point that Joe Manchin is never going to have more power than he does right now. Unless somehow in 2023, it's still a 50-50 Senate and it's still a Democratic House, two fairly implausible things. Otherwise, if there's more Democrats in the Senate, then he's not the 50th vote anymore for reconciliation bills. And on the other way, if it's not a Democratic House anymore, who cares about reconciliation? The reconciliation bill is not going to go anywhere. And so anything that happens is going to be bipartisan. So Manchin has a role to play in bipartisan legislation, but he can't single-handedly dictate the terms of a bill the way he can right now. So if I'm Joe Manchin and I'm in my mid-70s and I'm up for re-election in 2 years and the chances of being re-elected are a little shaky, and even if I got re-elected, I wouldn't have the same amount of power that I do right now. Why not use the power that you have to get what you want, not just to be nice to Democrats, but there's things you want for West Virginia. This is the vehicle to get them. You might as well put your cards on the table right now. And that appears to be what he did.
So here's my question to you, Bill. What did West Virginia get? What did Joe Manchin want or West Virginia want that is going to be delivered if this goes through?
Well, I think we're still a little sketchy on that because we only saw this one-page sheet. At least for me. I mean, I know the full text of the bill is out there, but I haven't poured through it line by line. It's one of those bills that's particularly hard to read because it says, change subsection 1A with this. You're like, what the hell is subsection 1A? What am I looking at? I'm not the best person to ask exactly what he got, but I do know two things. One is that he wanted permitting reform that cannot be done in reconciliation. That's not a budgetary thing. It's a policy thing. Having natural gas pipelines more easily established is something that Republicans like very much. He got Pelosi and Schumer to say, okay, we're going to do this separately from reconciliation. And he has talked a lot about building up hydrogen infrastructure in West Virginia. And he already got a provision in the infrastructure bill that already passed to create hydrogen hubs. And one of them is set to be in Appalachia. So he's already made some moves on that front. And the thing is with hydrogen, you can do hydrogen in a clean way without any natural gas involved. You can do it in a less clean way. And so Manchin wants it done in West Virginia, where there's some natural gas infrastructure. And my understanding from reporting that happened before the deal was that the electric vehicle tax credit, which apparently retains in this bill, would also allow for hydrogen fueled vehicles as well. It wouldn't be electric specific. And I believe I read that the way the credit is constructed, it's not necessarily specific to just electric, although it works a little bit better, the cleaner you get, a little bit more money, the more emissions that are cut. So I think that he's getting some stuff for hydrogen in this bill as well, on top of the permitting. So I think that's what's going on here.
Interesting. So I want to, you know, this is not the lead, this is not the most important takeaway, but I do think it's interesting, Bill, that, you know, as you alluded to, Republicans went along with this computer chip bill, and they went along with it under the guise of there wouldn't be any reconciliation bills the rest of the term.
Morgan, let's be very clear, though. Nobody said that. There's no evidence that Joe Manchin went to Mitch McConnell and said, no way, no how, and we're doing reconciliation. So your tweet the other day where you said, if you do reconciliation, this deal's off, you got my handshake on that, buddy. We have no evidence that Manchin did something that overt.
Fair point. However, obviously, McConnell said, we're going to, and by the way, Bill, you've been, I think you've also been someone who has popularized the notion that gridlock is not really as big a problem as people think, that you have made the point, maybe more than anyone else, that actually Congress does get stuff done. And that all this hand-wringing about gridlock and is actually overwrought. And so here we had another example where Republicans were working with Democrats to pass something that I think seems like a pretty important policy. And they telegraphed, like, hey, we're doing this. We're going to go along with you on yet another thing, but we really don't want you guys to push through anything via reconciliation for the rest of the term. And Democrats could have said, you know, no dice. Hey, just so you know, we're working on this other thing over here. But like 4 hours, Bill, 4 hours after this bipartisan legislation passes the Senate, it comes out that Manchin has crafted this deal with Schumer. You know, I'm not saying it's illegal what they did. Obviously, it's not. But it does strike me as unchivalrous, maybe as a word. And that doesn't seem to me to be incredibly helpful at a time where I think encouraging bipartisan comity would be a good thing.
I mean, if somebody actually broke their word, I would agree with you. I have no evidence that someone's word was broken here. These are all grownups. These are all professionals. If you don't have a deal in writing or a verbal handshake, you cannot assume you have that kind of deal. What Manchin said a couple weeks ago was, I don't want to do the climate and the tax pieces just yet until I see August inflation numbers. I still am ready to do the healthcare parts of a reconciliation bill. So he never said there would be no reconciliation. And Schumer and others were saying, okay, let's not assume Manchin is totally lost here. We're still going to talk. It is surprising that Manchin agreed to this before. If the same thing that Manchin said that he turned tail on, he didn't wait for the August inflation numbers.
Yeah. And they're not great, right? I mean, there's nothing that came out that if you were worried about the economy, I don't think any new news would have relieved.
Well, the Fed jacked up interest rates yesterday.
Yeah, that's true. But I think that was also expected, but that's not, I think that's a good sign, but it's not like we it's not evidence that things have turned around.
The only other thing that seems to have happened, and I don't know if this really was determinative, that Larry Summers talked to Joe Manchin and said, hey, come on, guy, this bill is anti-inflationary. What are you waiting for? When you raise taxes more than you spend money, that's taking money out of the economy. That is what's supposed to help curtail inflation. It's when you put too much money into the economy that you risk overheating it. What's weird to me is that Manchin obviously knows this. he was arguing his bill was anti-inflationary in the first place. It was weird that he was all of a sudden flinching on it. But apparently that conversation happened.
Let's talk about some of the things that we think are at least in the framework or that were, you know, the top lines. Talk, if you would, about the SALT deduction and the carried interest. Those seem to me to be two of the big top lines.
Well, SALT's not in this. I mean, those are two things that are being talked about because we don't know if every Democrat's going to support this because of those two aspects. Mainly Congresspeople from New Jersey, New York, New Jersey area, you know, Josh Gottheimer in the House, Bob Menendez in the Senate, they've been the biggest saying no SALT, no deal. There was a cap on the SALT, the state and local tax deduction. It's a pretty hard cap put on it in the Trump tax cuts.
So let me slow you down and walk myself through this slowly. So in some states, there are no state taxes, right? So like Florida and Texas have no state taxes. So it doesn't, if you can't deduct state taxes and you live in Florida, that's not a problem.
Well, I imagine they have something. I don't know if they have literally nothing, but
they don't have state income tax.
They might have an income tax.
But if you live in New Jersey, where presumably the state income tax is very high, being able to deduct that from your federal income tax would be a huge deal. Do I have this right?
Yes. Okay. I mean, so this is something that if you live in a higher taxed, higher state to income, higher tax statewide state, excuse me.
So in a way, this is a subsidy for blue states.
Well, I think that's the way a lot of Republicans have looked at it. If you live in those states, you have more of a sort of conservative sounding argument. You should be against double taxation. I've already paid a tax on this dollar. The federal government shouldn't get to tax me a second time. This was an issue in the Reagan years. Mario Cuomo made this point very forcefully in the 80s. But more recently, you've had progressives, even in the New York area, particularly people like AOC, saying, hey, the people that benefit from this are upper income earners. So screw them. Who cares if it's double taxation? You know, this is a subsidy to people on the high end, and we shouldn't be bending over backwards for them.
Why the high end?
Well, I mean, a state income tax.
They're paying more taxes because they make more money.
Yeah, yeah. So it definitely is crossing party and ideological lines, this whole issue. But as a matter of head counting, you know, Democrats can't lose a single senator. They can't lose five House members. So are Menendez, Gottheimer, others prepared to go to the mat on this? That we don't know, number one, because there's nothing about SALT in the deal as it stands.
Then why am I hearing about it? If it's not in there, why have I been hearing about it?
Because these folks want it in there. They want SALT relief. They want the cap raised, and it's not raised. The other issue is the one pager. Again, I haven't looked at the literal text, so forgive me if this is more known than I know about it. I've seen it reported that the carried interest loophole is closed, and I'm a little hesitant to be sure. Is it fully closed or is it narrowed in some way? I'm not 100% sure. So apologies for being ignorant on that. But as described in Bloomberg, they say the plan would end the carried interest tax break used by private equity and hedge fund managers to lower their tax bills. That allowed for a share of an investment manager's income to be classified as a capital gain, which is taxed at a 23.8% tax rate instead of the top 37% tax rate for salary and wage earnings. And this is something right. that Kyrsten Sinema was apparently opposed to doing, closing this loophole. And her office said yesterday she has no comment and she's looking over the language. So right. is she prepared to sink the whole bill over saving this one loophole that we don't know yet?
So let me ask you about this. Okay, so I know that like investment income is not taxed until you actually sell. But that's not what this is. This is for people who are managing the funds who have to get paid for what they're doing. What's the theory behind why should a investment professional be taxed at a lower rate than a working stiff, someone who's out there working in a factory, work, you know, whatever, a cop, a waitress? Why should someone, I mean, look, you probably don't even think they should, but like, what's the theory behind why they should be taxed at a lower rate?
Well, I don't think it's just the working stiff moving the trade. I mean, these are people who have, who are the investors. And under the spirit of the law, was, you know, Democrats don't like capital gains tax as it is. They don't necessarily think that capital gains should be treated lower than other income. They see it as rewarding speculation and not true investment. And that these are wealthy guys that should have to pay the full freight on the on their income. You know, back in the 90s, Paul Tsongas had a proposal saying the capital gains should really only apply if you hold your investment for a certain number of years. So if you're really investing in a business, that should be encouraged and be taxed at a lower rate. If you're just moving money around, that should not get special treatment. So it all fits into the
theory. I mean, is there, you know, normally I would be making this allegedly conservative argument, and I normally, and I'm not carrying my weight here, obviously, but like, what is there a legitimate argument for why, you know, people who manage investments or whatever should be paying a lower tax rate than someone who's just earning a wage?
I mean, I assume the conservative argument is that investment is good. Investment is the life blood of the financial economy. Without investment, that jobs don't get created, yada yada yada. Yeah, I assume that's the argument.
Working is good too. And maybe that should be taxed at a lower rate. I don't, just maybe someone who could sound off in the comments. I would love hear.
I've seen Republicans say the capital gains tax should be zero. You know, that is more, even more important than, you know, zeroing out other taxes, because that is how this is what makes capitalism great, is investment.
Yeah. Spurs, you know, I guess the theory is it spurs investment that creates jobs and all that, but it really doesn't seem fair, does it? That someone who doesn't make anything except interest, and like you say, Bill, I mean, there's investing and then there's investing. And some of these people, I was, it's amazing that, you know, like Jared Polis, the governor of Colorado, very popular, apparently, you know, was able to skirt paying taxes. I was just reading about this recently.
He's a wealthy guy, Jared Polis.
I think he put like $20 million of his own money into his. Art Laffer works for him, I think. Anyway, interesting point. If anyone has thoughts, please let us know in the comments.
Well, have thoughts on how Matt Lewis went woke on capital gains taxes. When the hell did that happen?
Bill, I'm a blue collar guy. You know that. I mean, I'm wearing a white collar right now, but son. Son of a prison guard, straight out of Wolfsville, Maryland. It just doesn't seem fair, does it?
Well, I think the bigger breakthrough here for Democrats is because, you know, on the tax front, this is a whole lot less of increased taxes on the wealthy that the Democrats wanted to have. This is very much shrunken down from where the Build Back Better bill was. the climate piece is the thing that Democrats, I think, are most excited about. The fact they're getting anything at all. I mean, they're saying
right,
this.
Talk about that. What is the climate piece?
Let me see if I can. Because I don't have it all, you know, at the ready.
So. Damn it, Bill. You know, I expect. Look. All I ask is that you show up for your job, knowing every possible answer, every possible question I'm going to ask. And if you're not committed to this, you know, there are other people that could be here.
Well, again, this is reading off of Bloomberg that. The bill includes $4,000 tax credits for lower middle income buyers to use to purchase electric vehicles, and up to $7,500 tax credit for new vehicles. $60 billion of incentives to bring clean energy manufacturing into the U.S. Production tax credits to accelerate U.S. manufacturing of solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, and critical minerals processing. Investment tax credits to build clean tech manufacturing plants to make EVs, turbines, and other products. Tax credits for consumers who add renewable energy items to their homes, including efficient heat pumps, rooftop solar, electric HVAC, and water heaters. $9 billion in home energy rebate programs for low-income consumers, making their homes more energy efficient. And you got on the healthcare front, empowering Medicare to negotiate for lower drug prices, capping what seniors on Medicare pay for drugs each year at $2,000. Requiring pharmaceutical companies to rebate Medicare if they raise prices on their drugs more than inflation, and extension of augmented subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. So this is being touted by Democrats as the biggest investment in clean energy ever. It's less than they were going to get in Build Back Better, but it's still more. But they thought they were about to get zero. So, and it's supposed to cut emissions by 40% over a certain time frame. These are things that the average taxpayer is not going to get in their wallet by November.
Mm-hmm.
There's always the downside risk for any of these big Democratic bills that people don't feel it right away, and so they don't get the political benefit right away. But it's points on the board. It's the left and the middle in their party singing off the same song sheet. So you have the potential of going into the midterm with the Democratic Civil War, you know, at a minimum. So the narrative is not Democrats talking smack about each other, talking about primarying Sinema and Manchin. That might get pushed to the side, and you get a more unified message about we're making Washington work. We're investing in infrastructure, we're investing in clean energy. We are doing something on gun safety. We are tackling inflation. We are having the wealthy pay their fair share. We know it's been a hard couple of years, but we're on the right track. Look at these crazy people the Republicans are nominating.
Well, that part is certainly true. I will say, though, here's something you will be able, if this bill passes, Republicans will be able to say, so first of all, am I correct? We are now in a recession. Did that happen?
Well, again, it depends on how you define it. If you're defining it as two quarters of,
which is how we always define
growth. I mean, yeah, there's generally been determined by the National Bureau of Economic Research. My understanding is that their definition is a little bit more nuanced than that, and so they may not come out and say officially that they're considering a recession. We know that Biden's team has been pushing all week that this should not be considered a recession because, you know, job growth is great. And you had the Fed chair yesterday say the same, saying that there's the other data points are so strong that it makes you question if the GDP number is even accurate. So
okay,
we're going to get some conflicting narratives on this score.
Whether Republicans say in the middle of a recession or whether they say during a time of inflation, what they can say is you know, during a time of inflation, the Democrats' response has been to spend what? Another trillion? I don't know how much. Hundreds of millions of dollars.
They might say it that way.
And raise taxes.
Right.
They could say that.
They could say that. In other words, the two things contradict each other. The net of the bill is not spending. The net is deficit reduction because the revenue increases are more than the spending. But of course, Republicans aren't. I agree with you. They'll probably say in the ads the way you described it.
Yeah, and it's honestly true. I mean, they can fairly fill. Let's maybe not fairly, but they can certainly say that, you know, during a time of inflation, Democrats' first response was to spend hundreds of millions of dollars and to raise taxes. Doesn't seem like a great idea, does it?
Well, I mean, look, the Democrats already spent, the big spending was ARPA, was the American Rescue Plan. I mean, that was $1.9 trillion not offset with tax revenue. So if you want to accurately ding Democrats for fueling inflation, that's the fairer charge to make. You know, when Reagan ran against Ford in 1976 and was criticizing Ford for inflation, he said the answer was a balanced budget. He didn't just say cut spending. He said a balanced budget. Now, I'm not saying Reagan was running around talking about tax increases, but
this is before Reagan was a, we mentioned Art Laffer.
Right.
Two mentions for Art Laffer in one show, Bill. That was before Reagan and, you know, the Laffer curve. And that was when Reagan was more of a balanced budget, green eye shade Republican.
But if you want the federal government's fiscal policies to not add to inflation, you want to at least have a balanced budget or negative. Now, mind you, I don't believe that we're getting to a balanced budget because of this bill. We are reducing the size of the deficit relative to GDP. And that's already been happening because the spending on ARPA had stopped. That was last year. And of course, on Donald Trump's watch during the pandemic in 2020, there was a whole ton of trillions of spending that was not offset. So we've ended that period of crisis spending. And so the deficit is coming down anyway. Now we're getting the deficit reduction a little more so with this deal. So, I mean, so I understand your point, Matt, that optically spending plus taxes looks bad. But if you're a Democrat, if you're trying to achieve the twin goals of investment in critical sectors of the economy while also not contributing to inflation by reducing the deficit, they are doing those things. It may be awkward to do so. And this would argue Manchin's point 2 weeks ago. This might look bad. This might upset people in an inflationary time. But policy-wise, it is an anti-inflationary thing to do. While also keeping your eye on the long ball. I mean, you could, you know, turn off the spigot and just like, let's cut the budget by $2 trillion. But that would inflict a lot of pain on people to do it that way. So you try to do things in a nuanced way that's not too disruptive to the economy and doesn't sacrifice some long-term goals.
But other than your column, what changed?
Well, Manchin said he wanted to wait till the inflation numbers came out in August, and he didn't. And honestly, it was stupid to hinge us on the current month's inflation numbers. This is not a bill designed to have instantaneous impact. This is about the long view. The thing happening to cut inflation down immediately is what the Fed is doing. Interest rates. That's the immediate thing you do. So it was a weird thing for Manchin to say in the first place. It made people think he was being disingenuous and wasn't serious about coming to a deal. So it's really hard to fully understand what's going on in his mind. But what makes the thing that makes sense to me is his recognition that he has power to deliver for his state, and he wanted to exercise it while he had it.
Don't you think that he would still have a lot of power? He could become Susan Collins. I mean, if Republicans take the House as they're expected to, and if the Senate stays, it doesn't even have to be 50-50, but if it's, you know, if it's narrow, then presumably Manchin would still be a much sought after vote, and he could potentially still negotiate a lot of stuff with Republicans.
What do you think Republicans want to do in either 2023 with a Democratic president or 2025 if they have a Republican president? What do you think they really want to do that would require 60 votes and some Democratic cooperation?
Okay. What if it's 50-50 still?
I mean, if you're literally, well, if it's 50-50 and you have a Republican president, then they want to get their 50. They want their own people organized. So, I mean, what we know is tax cuts you can do by yourself. You know, in the Bush years, they did tax cuts to reconciliation, but they were at 50-50 when they started. And they weren't sure they could hold on to, you know, John McCain. I don't think they had John McCain on that first tax cut. So they needed to get a little bit of Democratic support, and they got it. Under Trump, they did reconciliation for tax cuts with no Democratic votes at all. So to the extent that tax cuts are what they care about, Manchin's not a player there. If they want to do some policy changes, then they would need Democratic support. But honestly, I just don't know what those things are. I think there are things they want to do that are hard right, but the evidence is that they don't want to water those things down. And the Democrats probably wouldn't even cooperate for them. And Democrats presume that Republicans might just abolish the filibuster and do it without Democratic support anyway. Now, Mitch McConnell says he's not going to do that. I don't know if I'd say I take him at his word, but I sort of lean towards him being on the level there. But also, McConnell can't live forever.
He didn't do it Trump was mocking McConnell.
Yes.
For not doing it, and McConnell held firm. So.
Right. So I think McConnell is serious about not wanting to get rid of the filibuster, but, you know, he's not a spring chicken. He's not going to be a majority leader. He's not going to be Senate Republican leader forever. And I can't really have the same confidence in whoever follows him. So if there's some things that Republicans really, truly want to do, I don't believe they're going to do it by negotiating with a bunch of Democrats. I think they're going to wait to get rid of the filibuster.
All right. We should probably stop talking so we can post this so it's relevant, because things will develop. But a couple quick things we should hit on our way out the door, Bill. You had a really good piece that I think got some pushback about how Joe Biden should ride off into the sunset. But unlike other people who are framing it as like he should go because he's too old or whatever, you're saying he should go because that's a smart move if you're him, because second terms usually stink. But talk about that.
Second terms are usually bad for two reasons. You don't have a cooperative enough Congress. You're not at the peak of your mandate, so you can't wrangle supermajorities to do your big wish list items. And if there's any kind of scandal brewing, it tends to percolate up to the surface by the second term. Those are the two big things you've got to worry about.
Ron Contra, you've got Monica Lewinsky. Even I guess Obama would be something of an exception. Maybe there were
I think Obama had a better second term than most. He didn't have a big scandal, but he surely didn't.
Benghazi or stuff like that.
That was the very tail end. It didn't really disrupt
He wasn't directly implicated either.
Well, really tried. It's like Republicans tried. But whether that was a real scandal or a bogus scandal is obviously eye of the beholder. What is true is that foreign policy is a double-edged sword for second terms. On one hand, because Congress usually isn't super cooperative with second-term presidencies, what legacy items presidents tend to have is on the foreign policy front, where they have more leeway. So, you know, Reagan did have the INF treaty with Gorbachev. Bill Clinton did oust Milosevic and have the Good Friday Agreement. Barack Obama had the Iran deal. But, you know, you're not in full control of the world. So, you know, ISIS flares up, which is what led to the uprising in Benghazi, Syria, bedeviled Obama throughout his second term. So the world is never something you can count on being your political friend in any term of a presidency.
Nixon with China, right?
Well, that was one of his better moments.
I believe weren't his foreign policy successes in the second term, which obviously was interrupted by his resignation. I think that's right.
It wasn't 72. It wasn't before.
I could be wrong.
Re-election. Yeah, that was 72. That was February 72.
Okay.
I think that was done in part because they wanted wins before 72.
I think your point though is obviously true that second terms are usually not what they're cracked up to be.
And specific to Biden. And so if they're always bad, why do presidents want them? Why do they even run again at all? And I think it's because, I mean, beyond just the basic don't want to walk away from power, to be a lame duck in your first term undermines your first term. You want your party to feel like their fate is intertwined with your fate. Yeah, maybe you want the opposite party to think you got such popularity, the public's behind you, that it's even threatening to your own reelection if you're going to get cross-wired with me. So you got to keep that perception that you're in the game still going so people don't just run off and start being lone rangers. In Biden's case, whatever he's going to get off the progressive agenda wish list, I think we're done. I think the Manchin deal is the last thing because the likelihood of keeping the House is so small. I mean, it could happen. I'm not saying it's impossible that it can't happen for the rest of the first term. I think the Senate looks a lot in relatively good shape for Democrats, but the House is much more tenuous. And then you get to 2024, where the Senate map is just terrible for Democrats. You got there are three red state Democrats, Manchin, Tester, Brown. They're all up. You got seven others in lighter blue states. And Republicans aren't defending any blue states, and only two light red states. So, I mean, it's not saying it's impossible there could be a Democratic trifecta in 2025, but very, very unlikely. So you're talking about more painful negotiations with stingy Republicans for the entirety of the second term. I'm not saying there's a scandal looming. You know, of course, I'm sure Republicans want to make Hunter Biden into something. But otherwise, I'm not presuming there's like a real bona fide scandal in the administration. But it seems unlikely you're going to get some moment where all the stars are aligned to go get Build Back Better off the bookshelf and drop it on Congress. So why not say peace out? You know, here's what I did. I got through the pandemic. Unemployment is low. We unified NATO to constrain Russia. We invested in clean energy. We got gun safety. We invested in infrastructure. Tough issues that had been bedeviling past presidents. I did it. You're welcome, America. See you on the beach in Rehoboth.
So first, obviously, we neglected to mention George W. Bush's second term, which you do mention in the column. And
Social Security privatization was a bust. Hurricane Katrina, Iraq War quagmire, lose the Congress in 2006. I mean, here's a case where he had a trifecta. He had a trifecta in 2005. thought it meant he had a mandate and was proven very wrong very quickly. So you usually don't even start with a trifecta. And if you have one, you tend to lose it by that midterm.
I guess part of the problem is we, as far as I know, Bill, we don't have a tradition. There is no example, I guess, of a president sort of declaring victory. I mean, TR tried to do it, and then he comes back, you know. But he, even there, that has an asterisk because he had served, you know, part of McKinley's term, right? So I don't know of an example of a one-term president who left on his own terms and
Polk
declared victory. So being a two-term president is generally like, to be taken seriously, you have to have been a two-termer.
There are only three presidents, I believe, that made one-term pledges, which are Polk, Hayes, and Buchanan. And only Polk of those three do you say, like, that guy did what he set out to do. He had four big things and he did them. Peace out. You have Teddy and Coolidge, who ascend upon a president's death. And so they had, you know, one term pluses, and were both pretty popular throughout their presidencies. We don't have polling to quantify it, but general sense is that they were in good shape. But both choose not to run, thinking that it is a violation, you know, more or less a violation of George Washington's precedent. In fact, Teddy Roosevelt made his pledge right upon winning his election outright. He then later regrets having done so and tries to run in, you know, 1912. And Coolidge just announces he's not going to run, you know, midway through his full term. So if you want to argue these are people that had good second terms, but not quite technically second terms, you know, have at it. But as far as people who were elected twice, and I went back in my piece 100 years to Wilson, you know, they all were very, very trying. I mean, not without any successes in some cases, but very trying and not fun experiences where they got to do their biggest legacy items.
I mean, I'm really glad that Reagan had a second term. And I think that he was able to kind of complete his agenda, including, you know, especially the ultimate collapse of the Soviet Union. But it was the second term, because not only did you have the Iran-Contra scandal, which potentially could have sunk him, but you also had a situation where he really lost his first string advisors and staffers. And so by the end of it, it was a very, it was really the third string probably.
Well, I mean,
running the show.
And I want to put Reagan's second term in some starker relief. I mean, it's a fascinating second term. I'm not saying this to be mean or political or dismissive, but I mean, this is the order of events. So on one hand, you can say Reagan had an idea that we're going to, you know, spend the Soviets into oblivion militarily, which seems to have had some basis, that the Soviets were squeezed financially because of the arms race. In the fall of 1986, they have the Reykjavik summit, which they talk about like eliminating nuclear weapons altogether, but Reagan can't give up Star Wars, and so the talks collapse. And there's that famous picture of the two of them walking out with the stone cold faces. Reagan's not hurt politically by this. He's seen as sort of, you know, standing up for his principle, but Reagan volunteered eliminating nuclear weapons. I mean, he was genuinely concerned about it, so he didn't really get what he wanted out of that summit, nor did the Soviets. Then the midterm happens, which are terrible. They lose. Republicans lose the Senate in 1986. So, I mean, the Democrats already had the House, but there were a lot of conservative Democrats at the time. So Reagan still had something to work with. But now he loses the Senate, which puts the kibosh on the judiciary project. He nominates Robert Bork the following year and loses in part because he doesn't control the Senate anymore. So that has a real consequence. Right after the midterm loss is when Iran-Contra explodes, literally like weeks afterwards. His national security advisor has to resign the month of November 1986. And as that continues to fester, that's when Gorbachev says, hey, Ron, can we talk about a smaller nuclear arms treaty? You know, let's limit some medium-range missiles. Reagan is now desperate for a win because he wants Iran-Contra off his back. And so he jumps at the chance and they do that deal. So it is a win. I mean, he does achieve a real success with Gorbachev. And now, mind you, there are conservatives at the time that are mad at Reagan because they think they got the Soviet Union on the ropes and he's giving them a lifeline with this deal.
I think George Will possibly, as memory serves, was one of them.
I think that's right. And it's not until 1989, when Bush is the president of the Berlin Wall falls, and then Gorbachev is ousted, you know, soon after. So I think Reagan deserves a pretty decent share of credit for the strategy. And I think he deserves credit for the treaty. But it's mixed in with other political setbacks that occurred. It's just simply like hitting his mark. So like doing exactly what he set out to do.
That's true. Yeah. The second term. I think your point's well taken. All right, Bill, we're about out of time. But we do have a couple of several elections coming up this week. I guess the most prominent, we've got, Missouri with Eric Greitens. We've got Arizona with the Senate race with Blake Masters, the gubernatorial race with Robson versus Kerry Lake. And then up in Michigan, Myers, the guy who replaced Justin Amash, who voted, Myers voted for impeachment, as being, I guess Democrats are boosting his more MAGA primary opponent. Those are the three that I think are probably the most important, but what have I missed?
Well, I mean, those are, I think, the races where you have, you know, the Republican Civil War being played out. You also have, in Kansas, a state constitutional amendment on the ballot that would ban abortion. That was already in the works before the Dobbs decision, but now has far greater import. And that's, I'll pull say that that's a tight race. So this is the first test of how open even pretty red states are to truly banning abortion when you put it in the hands of the voters, not just Republicans who are governors or state legislatures. So there's that. There's also an interesting in Missouri where, you know, Greitens is on the ballot in the Republican primary, and apparently his numbers are going down, which is good for Republicans if Greitens loses. You have a fairly tightly contested Democratic primary between a more populist candidate named Kuntz and a scion of the Bush beer family, Tracy Bush Valentine. That's a very close race. So if Greitens managed to win, I think people look at that race as more possible for Democrats. If it's one of the other two candidates, maybe less so. But there's also an independent, a Republican independent named Wood, who is backed by former Senator Danforth?
The guy who gave us the guy who gave us Josh Hawley, right?
Yeah, and Clarence Thomas.
He later regretted Josh Hawley.
Yes. I would be interested to see if Wood has legs if Greitens isn't the nominee. This is someone who's running as an independent, but says he would caucus with the Republicans. So it's not like an Evan McMullen, who I think hasn't said who he'd caucus with. That's over in Utah. So lots of happening on the ballot.
When's the Utah thing?
Well, they already had their nominations. McMullen's running as an independent, but Democrats chose to endorse him and not run their own candidate.
Okay.
And the Kansas abortion thing is interesting to me. You know, one thing I want to plug, Matt, is that I'm guest hosting a podcast this week called Politics, 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 which is normally hosted by Justin Robin Young. And I've been a guest on his show before. You can check out that podcast at politicspoliticspolitics.com. So I'm doing a one show that's for everybody. And there's some bonus shows that are for their Patreon supporters. So if you go to that website, you can find out how to be a Patreon supporter of that show. At one point I noted in one of the bonus shows is, as I was saying earlier here, Democrats have the potential of running in a more unified way than perhaps a president's party normally gets to run in a midterm. And on the Republican side, we're seeing some division amongst Republicans about how to handle abortion. The Times has a story about this today, that Indiana is now flummoxed. What exact abortion ban should we do? How far should we go? And you don't normally have that kind of division in the opposition party. But what's unusual this year is that a giant policy decision was made in effect by the opposition party, because the Supreme Court came in and effectively said, boom, abortion can be banned wherever you want. You don't usually have an action like that taken by the out party. So it kind of, it scrambles the normal dynamic in a midterm. Not to say that I know it's going to benefit Democrats, but it does raise an eyebrow and say, you know, this midterm has a set of factors that are not like the usual midterm.
Before I let you go, any predictions? Does Greitens survive? Does Carrie Lake win? What do you see happening in your crystal ball?
I'm not gonna crystal ball this at all. No way, no how. I mean, from what you see in the polling, Lake looks good versus Robson. Last two polls, I saw it up by double digits.
It depends what poll you're looking at, though.
The last two that I saw, she was looking pretty solid. I'm not saying there are all the doubts.
But Robson released a internal public opinion strategies poll that shows it neck and neck.
Right, but that's internal, so that's less.
I know. My gut is Lake wins, but I'm basing it really off of just, you know, as crazy as Lake obviously must be, because she was a TV reporter, broadcaster for decades, she's really good on TV. I think that her persona is better. And so that's why I'm going. If I'm betting, I'm betting Lake.
Well, I get the impression that the attempt to take out Lake has been, she's not really a conservative. She was for Obama. Don't trust her. Yeah. And
that didn't work against Trump. All those things were true. I mean, of Trump.
Trumpers, I don't think care about what you did, even as. I mean, they're trying to bring up things that she said about Trump, you know, in 2015, 2016. And I think Trumpers are welcoming to Trumpian converts. As long as they go all in, I don't think they care. And I think she been fairly, I don't know exactly what you said about her narrative, but I don't think she's trying to pretend that she was a Trump sycophant in 2006, you know? But she's on the Trump train now.
Or even 16.
Yeah.
but no, I agree. I think that I'm not sure why they're running that play, because I think you're right. I don't think it works. No, but there are occasions, of course, where like Brian Kemp in Georgia was able to fend off a challenge. And
someone who had a record of his own to run on.
Yeah.
I mean, Robson is not someone who's run for office before. She worked in the Reagan administration, otherwise has been a wealthy funder of things. So she doesn't have that much of her own record to point to and say, I'm the truest conservative here. I think people who know her from the Reagan years, these are people who are more insidery, they have a trust in her, but that doesn't trickle down to the average voter. Carrie, like, again, someone who's been on the news, so it's more of a known commodity. Yeah. And someone who was saying, I've been in the media, and I know what they're really like. I know what goes
where, down. Where have we heard that before?
Hours of the media industry. They like having a figure who spins that narrative.
I mean, I'm going with a totally anecdotal, totally superficial prediction, which is that Carrie Lake is good on TV. She seems authentic. She seems tough. And Robson seems temperamentally, just her vibe seems established, like a kind of a weak establishment type. Like, that could be completely unfair, but that's where I'm betting. And I hope I'm wrong, Bill. I hope I'm wrong.
Well, look, Arizona is clearly a purple state. Mark Kelly is a solid Democratic nominee, the current incumbent senator there. And it's the Secretary of State, the current Secretary of State, who's a Democrat, who's going to be the gubernatorial nominee for Democrats. They're going to have decent nominees. And if it's like mainstream Democrats versus MAGA Republicans in Arizona, it is not a given that state flips red.
I wonder how much cinema would try to help Mark Kelly, if at all. What do you think?
Because
she seems like she might have a lot of appeal to independents and even Republicans.
I would think it's in her interest to help. You know, she has a certain interest in being seen as her own person, who's not really a person of a party. But there is this cloud over her head that she's going to face a primary challenge in 2024. She has built up a record saying, look, I'm someone who puts country over party, and I get things done for Arizona. I think she has incentive to, particularly up against MAGA candidates, to say, Mark Kelly is like me. Mark Kelly is someone who's going to work across the aisle to get things done for Arizonans. And
yeah, I mean,
Blake Masters is not.
If you're Kyrsten Sinema, do you want Carrie Lake to be in the Senate as your, you know, junior senator?
Lake's governor. Lake will be governor.
I'm sorry, Lake's governor. Okay, so still, she's part of the delegation. It's not as bad, right? I mean, so it'll be Blake Masters, I guess, presumably it would be the... I don't think
she wants to work with Carrie Lake. I don't think she wants to work with Blake Masters. I think she'd much rather work with fellow moderate Democrats like herself.
All right. You can tell by me botching that and conflating this that I need a vacation, Bill. Well, the good news is I'm actually leaving town. I'm going to Arizona, of all places. And so we won't be here next week.
You should be doing a special Arizona DMZ edition.
I could probably do it with some great background, you know, with Sedona maybe, or the Grand Canyon. I'm going to try to not.
But you go to Phoenix, that. Right? You go to Phoenix in an air conditioned hotel. You don't.
I'm
going to
be all
right?
over. I'm going to no. I'm outside, man.
Okay, all right.
But poolside, Bill, as one does. I mean, you know, poolside. So anyway, I'm going to try to not do a DMZ next week. But if there's an emergency, I'm going to bring this microphone. I paid for this microphone. I'm bringing it with me, and I'm bringing my computer. So if I am drafted into an emergency DMZ, then that'll, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
All right.
What do you want to plug?
I already plugged. I think I had to plug has been plugged. Check out my guest hosting duties on the Politics podcast. Check out my Washington Monthly piece about Biden the second term. Check out the article that saved the planet. Manchin shouldn't throw away his shot in Real Clear Politics. And what do you got, Matt?
Read all Bill's stuff and check out Matt Lewis and the News podcast. Rate. Oh, here's something that you should do. You should go to youtube.com/Matt Lewis and subscribe. That way you will be alerted every time a DMZ with me and Bill Scherer pops up. And you should follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. We are right at the 1 hour mark coming up momentarily. Bill Scherer, I'll see you hopefully in 2 weeks.
All right. Take care.
All right.